To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Have you seen KBOO's Fuzzy Boo Van? It's a giant furry blue Muppet mobile that brings music and joy wherever it's found in Portland and across the region. We're having a contest this summer. If you spot the van, post a picture on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the hashtag FuzzyBoo and you'll be entered to win a chance to have FuzzyBoo at your event, as well as other prizes. Each picture you take is another chance to win. For more info and clues on where to find the van, go to kboo.fm/FuzzyBoo.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime, and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. Liberation Literacy, a racial justice reading group founded and directed by Dr. Garrett Felber, meets weekly at Columbia River Correctional Institution in Portland, where students recently interviewed National Book Award winner and historian Dr. Ibram X. Kendi about his book, Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America.
My name is Marcus Williams, and I'm one of the participants in Liberation Literacy here in Portland, Oregon, at Columbia River. And I had a question from one of the pages of your book. So on page 165, it says that a disciple of Denmark Vesey, David Walker, told enslaved blacks to mobilize themselves for the Second American Revolutionary War. My question to you is, we here, the black community, are under attack in Portland, Oregon. Threats against our black daughters, sisters, and mothers, along with the black community at large, are being verbally expressed and physically carried out. What are some of the ways of defensive mobilization that you think could help thwart some of the onslaught of today's violence against us here in Oregon?
I think from the beginning of this country, black communities have been under onslaught, whether by slaveholders or slave catchers or lynchers, and now, of course, police officers. I think there certainly should be mechanisms to defend ourselves. But I think one of the things that should be happening that I think is not happening is, I think within the black community, when black people are subject to police violence, they're sometimes, if not most times, that person is being questioned by the community about some of the things that they did. Oh, well, why did you do that? Well, why did you, you know, do this? Why didn't you do this to the police officer? Why did you call the police? And I think first and foremost, we cannot place any blame on the black victim, and in the same way that a raped victim is never to blame. You know, I think I wanted to sort of start off with saying that. I think secondly, we have to recognize as a community why this violence is so persisting and so pervasive, and how and why politicians and jurors and prosecutors and even cops themselves could continue to inflict this violence or allow this violence and simultaneously think they're living in a post-racial society. And I think the answer to that question is racist ideas. But the greater answer to racist ideas is the need to maintain racist policies. And the need to maintain racist policies allows particular people who are in power and who benefit from those policies to stay in power. And so I guess what I'm ultimately saying is, I think, you know, one of the ways in which black people and even any group of people are able to become safe, you know, is by assuming power. And I think that's one of the reasons why power and the striving for empowerment and power has gone hand in hand with black people's efforts to maintain safety.
With that being said, you use the word empowerment and to empower, right? So with the excerpt from what was said in the book, when they spoke about defensive mobilization in this day and age, actually it puts us in a powerless position, because if we take defensive action against the powers that be, then we're actually putting ourselves in harm's way. Because also in off of page 173, Garrison's philosophy basically for empowerment was moral persuasion. So what are some suggestions you might be able to give us that can empower us in terms of defensive mobilization that won't put us in harm's way to be more inflicted pain upon us right here where we are right now? Because right now we're under attack here in Portland, Oregon.
In the most practical sense, people who are truly concerned about defending and saving Black lives, particularly from the violent wrath of police officers, have to mobilize and organize a power base in the community that's going to focus its efforts on the powers that allow police officers to do these things. And I guess what I'm ultimately saying is, you know, these police officers, these people who are inflicting this violence have been empowered by other people and have been empowered by a particular set of policies. I have been empowered by a particular set of ruling politicians. And so in order to basically remove their power, Black people and their allies have to assume power and have to change policy. That is the only way that those police officers are going to stop doing that. The only other alternative, of course, and I think this is certainly something that is happening across the country, is for Black people to basically mobilize and organize themselves to try to keep themselves as far away from the police as possible. In the same way Black people try to keep themselves away from lynchers and the Ku Klux Klan, in the same way Black people try to keep themselves away from slave patrols, I think that's another thing that Black people can have certainly organized.
Hi, my name is Jarrell Lambert. Your book was amazing, man. It was very impactful. It had a lot of information in it, information that they don't really teach us, that they didn't teach us in schools and whatnot. So one of my questions for you is, what was one of the biggest challenges with you, you know, producing this book?
More or less writing this book and not going crazy. The book ended up being, you know, upwards of 500 pages, but I probably wrote out twice, not three times, more than that, of people who, of course, considered people who looked like me to be inferior. And so I think being able to read and write and reflect, you know, on all of this literature and all of these ideas that were denigrating Black people, and be able to sort of write it out in a way that people can understand was very difficult, because the words themselves and the ideas themselves were quite hurtful. So what I ended up doing, I think maybe a third of the way through the process, was instead of these ideas sort of angering me or making me sad, I eventually just started laughing them off. You know, I mean, these people were just so ridiculous to think that there's something inferior about Black people. And I think that I think got me through the final two thirds.
Another question I got for you is, we got this stigma of what we want from the outside world, how we want the outside world to treat us. But what do you think that we should do from within, you know, as Blacks, to have a better response to the outside world?
Well, you know, as I write in the book, I think the only thing that's wrong with Black people is that we think something is wrong with Black people. And so I think that's a major problem within the Black community. The Black community is not a monolith. So you have many different groups within the Black community. Black people are differentiated by gender, by sexuality, by class, by location, by nationality, ethnicity. And all of these different Black groups are looking upon these other Black groups as in some ways inferior, right? As opposed to different and simultaneously equal. And I think that's created a level of division within the Black community that has made it, of course, different to organize and mobilize. Now, I would not go as far to say that the fundamental problem of Black people is that they're not unified, because in many ways, we're more unified than white people. You know, if you look at our sort of political pattern, our voting patterns and other types of things. But I think that is certainly a problem. And I think we as a community, Black people as a community, need to recognize And I tried to sort of show this through this book, that racist ideas were primarily created for black consumption. And so, you know, we can understand how during slavery, it was in the interest of slaveholders to get their enslaved black people to believe they should be slaves, that black people are meant for slavery because they're the cursed descendants of Ham, because American slavery is civilizing them after the barbarism of Africa. These ideas, they wanted slaves to believe so those people would not run away, right? So those people would continue to work. So those people wouldn't resist slavery. And so what racist ideas ultimately do is it prevents people, but most specifically black people, from not resisting discrimination, from not resisting slavery, segregation, from not resisting mass incarceration. And so I think for us, if we release these racist ideas, we'll see that all of these problems are not necessarily self-inflicted, and we'll focus our efforts as a community on the real problem, which are racist policies and racially discriminatory policies and the powers that and the powerful people that enforce them.
I guess it's safe to say that we've been conditioned a certain way. And so what does modern day slavery look like to you?
So I think modern day slavery is quite similar to slavery in the past. I think modern day slavery exists in prisons. I think more people are enslaved outside of the prisons through the sex trade than ever before. At the height of the transatlantic slave trade, you have people all over the world who, particularly young people of color, particularly women who are driven into the slave trade. You even in on the West Coast, where I'm at in Florida, you have people who are coming over to work in fields picking crops who are more or less enslaved. There's a famous book called Nobody that documents slavery within the United States. But of course, people, as many people have talked about, are mentally enslaved, right? You know, and I certainly would agree with that. I mean, when a person who is dark-skinned thinks that there's something wrong with dark-skinned people, that's a representation of mental slavery.
Hi, my name is Ben. I've been here for about 7 months with this group. First, let me say I enjoyed your book. It was the second piece of history I recently read that you build your argument well. It was very enlightening. And the question I have is, I'm going to paraphrase here. I'm going to quote Martin Luther King, but I'm just paraphrasing because I can't remember exactly. But in his letter from the Birmingham jail, he spoke about forcing the tension in order to force the issue in the conversation. As I listen to Jeff Sessions, he's using the same language that Goldwater and everybody else use. They're just using different words for it. My question is today, how do we take the proactive initiative and force the issue? You know, via civil disobedience, protests, like how do we begin to take power?
I think first and foremost, we have to, as anti-racists, you know, as people who are interested in creating a different type of America, you know, have to go on the offensive. And I think the way we go on the offensive, at least as it relates to issues of race, is we uncover racial disparities. And then we uncover the discriminatory policies that are creating them. And then we uncover the powers that have the ability to change those discriminatory policies. And we go in an all-out assault against those powers. And then, of course, we create language that allows and therefore justifies, you know, our actions. I mean, really, this is not only is this a sort of a street fight or a power fight, you know, it's a language fight. And so we have to create a new set of languages, basically a new rhetorical sort of device. And one of the devices that I'm sort of trying to push more and more people to understand themselves is the notion of being an anti-racist, is recognizing that there's only really two perspectives. Either we think as an anti-racist or we think as a racist. Either we believe the racial groups are equal or we think certain racial groups are superior or inferior. Either we look at racial disparities and see what's wrong with people, or we look at racial disparities and see what's wrong with policies. But then also, I think we have to have a historical perspective. You mentioned the way in which Jeff Sessions is using language that Goldwater and others were using in the 60s. And I think us sort of being able to point that out on the spot will sort of undermine the use of that type of language. But in order for us to be able to point that out on the spot, we have to know the history and know it intimately. because otherwise we're going to go searching. And by the time we go searching and find it, that new language is already having circulated.
Hey, Abram, I'm Jared. And so my question that I have for you is, on your journey of writing this book, what is that you yourself got out of writing this book? Or what did you learn in terms of writing this book throughout the process?
Oh, man. So, I mean, I think there's so many different things that I learned. And I think the most important thing that I learned is the most important thing I think I communicated to the reader. And that is the sort of thesis of the book, this concept. You know, before writing Stand from the Beginning, I thought that really the central problem was ignorance and hate, and that it was just ignorance and hate that was driving people to produce racist ideas, and that it was these people who had these racist ideas were the people who were instituting racist sort of policies. And so that's one of the reasons why I was interested in journalism and I was interested in, you know, education, because, you know, I wanted to sort of use these tools to change people's minds, since I thought hate and ignorance was the core of the problem. Through researching Stand from the Beginning, but most specifically through distinguishing between the producers of racist ideas and the consumers of racist ideas, and focusing my narrative, Stand from the Beginning, on the producers of racist ideas, and asking the question over and over again, why was this person producing that racist idea at that time? So why did John C. Calhoun in 1837 produce the racist idea that slavery is a positive good? Like, what was happening at that point in time? And I found over and over again that these people, John C. Calhoun, Jeff Sessions, Thomas Jefferson, were not ignorant or even hateful. And these were very brilliant people who usually created these racist ideas to justify existing racist policies, and that these racist policies benefited people. So I realized through writing Stand from the Beginning, because I didn't know this beforehand, that the origins was self-interest. So you had people who had economic, political, and even cultural self-interest. And these were the people who instituted policies like slavery or segregation so they can make more money, so they can get elected to office or maintain office, so their culture, their religion could become preeminent. And then they circulated these racist ideas, and then we consumed them, and then we became ignorant and hateful. So ignorance and hate was actually the byproduct, the final sort of end. And so then what that does is it allows us to understand, if we understand better the origins, it gives us a better sense of where we should be fighting, right? That, you know, education and persuasion is good for the consumers of racist ideas, but it's not going to change the mind of the producers of racist ideas, because they have these hidden agendas of maintaining policies that benefit them.
If you just tuned in, this is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland, and you are listening to Adults in Custody at CRCI interviewing Dr. Abram X. Kendi about his book, Stamped from the Beginning.
How you doing? My name is Cavill. Your book is titled Stamped from the Beginning, and it probably goes back like 300-400 years when they got these ideas. How long will it take for people to come up off those ideas? Or do we have to start from the beginning?
I think if, for instance, if the people in this classroom were able to get into power and we were able to have control of the curriculum in schools, we were able to have control of the media, we were able to have control of the means of information, I think that it could be changed within two generations. But the chances of that happening, and even whether we would want that to happen, I think is, you know, it's not necessarily that high. I think Black people, if they had a choice of other people thinking that there's something wrong or inferior about them, looking at them and seeing people who are stupid and ugly and violent and all of these other things, if they had a choice of being in a world in which all of these people had these negative ideas about them, but these people did not have the power to do anything about it, or to be in a world where those people have those ideas and they also have the power to sort of carry them out, I think Black people would be able to live quite comfortably, or not necessarily completely comfortably, but much better in a world in which people had these ideas, but they didn't have the power to carry them out. So you thought Black workers are lazy, but every time you tried to deny a Black worker a job, you lost your business. like that type of world. I think that's the type of world that I'm pushing to create. And of course, hopefully over time, the ideas will wither away too. But I think what makes these ideas pernicious and what makes these ideas extremely harmful is because people have power to sort of carry them out, is because they make people believe that there's something wrong with Black people as opposed to discriminatory policies that is actually keeping Black people out of work. And so I want to focus on those discriminatory policies and try to get people from stop being blinded by these racist ideas so they don't see that the real problem are those policies. So Black people won't have to continue to be subjected from those policies. And if people want to continue thinking these false ideas about Black people, they can go right ahead.
Hi, my name is Joshua. I do want to acknowledge and appreciate the fact that you ended your book on a call to action. My question is, especially in the time of Garrison and a large portion of the first half of your book, there was debate over segregationists, abolitionists, and pro-slavery people and how you differentiated those groups. And I saw an extreme corollary to today's day and age with people who want to reform prisons, people who want to abolish prisons, and people who want to keep prisons the same. Do you agree with that?
I absolutely agree with that. And so I think, and that's one of the things that I've tried to, you know, sort of contribute with this text. So people can see really there's a three-way argument about these major issues. There's not a two-way argument. There's a three-way argument. You know, there's, you know, as it relates to prison, as you stated, you have people who want to expand prisons, like Jeff Sessions. You have people who want to gradually roll back prisons. And then you have people who want immediate and, you know, to all prisons. And I think these perspectives are coming from a different place, right? So the people who believe that we need to expand prisons also make these cases about how sort of evil and how people in prison cannot be reformed and that they're the sort of worst part of the society, all these false ideas that they circulate. And we don't even know that the real reason why they want prisons to be expanded is so they can have more people that they can exploit in prisons, is so that they can have more people who lose their voting rights, is so they can have more people who are not demanding jobs outside of prison. You know, all of these hidden agendas, right? So they have these hidden agendas that call for this expansion. And then you have that middling group that on some level, they say, yeah, there is something wrong with prisoners, but then there's also something wrong with prisons, right? And so they try to sort of reform both. Yeah, let's civilize prisoners and let's civilize, you know, the prisons. And then you have the people who are calling for the end of prison who say that there's nothing wrong with prisoners, that there's everything wrong with prisons. And so therefore, they focus their efforts on eliminating prisons. And that's really, to a certain extent, part of the larger debate about race in America. You have anti-racists who say there's nothing wrong with Black people, right? There's everything wrong with these institutions, with these policies. So let's focus our efforts on eliminating these institutions, on eliminating these policies. Then you have the people who are in the middle position say, you know what, there is something wrong with Black people, and there's something wrong with these policies. So let's focus our efforts on changing policies and civilizing Black people. And then you have the people who say there's nothing wrong with the institutions, there's nothing wrong with the policies, and there's everything wrong with Black people.
I have a secondary question, if that's okay. In here, I've done like over 30 programs and classes. Not a lot of them, hardly any of them were required of me. But they used to say things like I was an extraordinary criminal. And then I read a large portion of your book. They were saying the extraordinary Negro, which was really weird to not only read, but they use like the same wording and the same explanation for it. And I guess I want to ask in relation to that, because I'm a writer, I plan to write when I get out and publish things. And I do have white privilege on my side, so obviously there's a difference. But at the same time, do you think that in this day and age, if I were to come out of prison, stay out of prison, get published, get acknowledged in some capacity, that I will be regarded as an extraordinary criminal? And in what ways can I either combat that or like deflect that in other people who are of a similar background of criminality?
So, yes, I think that you would certainly be characterized as an extraordinary criminal. And then I think what we should understand, what that means, and I reference this in the case of Black people, that an extraordinary Negro, as Barack Obama was pretty much positioned as this extraordinary Negro, what that means is you're not like those ordinary inferior prisoners. You're not like those ordinarily inferior Black people. And so I think the way that Black people should push back against notions of the extraordinary Negroes, first and foremost, for them not to believe it, right? Because you do have Black people, just like you do have prisoners, who agree with the idea, yes, I am extraordinary. I'm not like those other, you know, prisoners. I'm better than them, right? You have people who believe that. And I think what happens is they don't understand that they're reinforcing their own inferiority and the inferiority of their group simultaneously. Because you're being read as this sort of exception. You've never even been to prison, or you're not really Black, right? You know, you're the exception. And so I think first and foremost, for people to not agree with that idea. And then secondly, to, of course, push back against those underlying ideas. And for people to say, no, I'm actually quite ordinary. And to tell stories about other prisoners, like the people in this room, you know, who are interested, you know, in education. And, you know, there are many different ways in which you can be educated. You can be educated by, of course, attending classes. You can be educated by thinking to yourself in your room. You can be educated by, you know, reading books by yourself.
Hello, my name is Will. First of all, I want to say I'm from Miami, so go Gators. And my first question is, I believe it was in your acknowledgments where you said that you wasn't originally going to write this book, but you started and got about 99 pages in. What made you continue to want to write?
So, you know, again, I originally was thinking that I was going to write this book on the origins of Black studies, which sort of led me down to this path of sort of chronicling the how sort of widespread racism was in higher education in the mid-1960s when students been demanding Black studies. And I think that then led me to realize that historians had largely written out of histories a group in the book that I classify as assimilationists, that assimilationist ideas had typically been identified as anti-racist ideas. Assimilationist ideas suggesting that Black people are culturally inferior or behaviorally inferior, or Black people are capable of being civilized or developed. These types of assimilationist ideas were classified in the traditional narratives of racism as anti-racism, as certainly not racist. And I think so that original sort of entryway into studying Black studies sort of led me into sort of realizing this because basically you had a situation in which historians were claiming that scientific racism had largely become marginal by the 40s, and you had students, Black students in the 60s, who were saying racism is everywhere, right? So basically what was happening there, and that sort of problem was based on how both groups were defining a racist idea. So the students in the 60s who were inspired by Black power were like, yes, if you say my culture is pathological, you're a racist. If you say that we shouldn't be ruling ourselves, you're a racist. But that wasn't, but traditionally racist ideas had been defined as notions that you're biologically or genetically inferior. And that's how people were, historians were able to end racism in the 40s, because those ideas largely became marginal in the 40s. And then they were taken over by ideas that, yeah, Black people's cultures and behaviors are inferior.
Hi, my name is Martinez, and I was wanting to see what's your opinion on prisoners. What comes to your mind?
I know the statistics about prisoners. And so I guess when I think of prisoners, first and foremost, and I think of people who, if we had a different set of policies and institutions in this country, would be thriving, as opposed to being in a cell somewhere. But I do know that, you know, prisoners are human. Prisoners make mistakes, just like people outside of prison make mistakes. Just like I've made mistakes, I've broken the law, but fortunately, I guess for me as an individual, that wasn't caught. So I think about that. I think about the things that I've done wrong that I could be in prison for when I think of prisoners. And I also think about my family members who are incarcerated, like my cousin who I grew up looking up to and who's extremely smart and gifted, You know, I think about how his life could have been different if certain things were different. And so, you know, these are the things that I think about when I think about prisoners.